Hello, I'm Jennifer White, and I'm an associate professor at the School of Child and Youth Care in the University of Victoria. And I'm speaking with my colleague, Patty.
I'm Patty Renahan. I'm an associate professor at Concordia University in Montreal in the Department of Applied Human Sciences. And we're here today to talk about our project that's looking at the suicide prevention gatekeeper training implementation across the province of British Columbia.
So there's a lot just in that title, so we might just break it down a little bit so folks know what we're talking about. So Patty, do you want to begin by just kind of explaining what gatekeeper training is and its relationship to suicide prevention?
Well, gatekeeper training is a real dominant approach in terms of suicide prevention. Gatekeeper training is an educational workshop, often constructed in either a 3 or 4 hour format or over a 2 day format, so approximately 14 hours. And gatekeeper training is designed to encourage participants to recognize warning signs for suicide or that someone might be in distress and respond in a particular way by identifying appropriate referral sources for them to connect to within a community. So referrals might be to a community mental health clinician or sometimes even emergency at the hospital.
And just to add, I know the other thing it's important to flag is sometimes gatekeepers are thought about as people who don't necessarily have clinical relationships with people, but they're just in informal relationships, often just in close proximity. So we think about teachers and coaches and people that have job descriptions that don't necessarily mean that they're going to be doing counseling, but that they can be a caring, responsible person to pass on information if somebody needs to be referred to further help.
Yes, that's right.
So then the other thing I thought we should unpack a little bit is about this idea of a provincial implementation, because here in British Columbia, where we're doing this study, the government invested $3 million over a 3-year period to ensure that 20,000 British Columbians would be trained as gatekeepers to recognize and respond to suicide in their communities. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's correct. So in 2015, the Ministry of Health gave $3 million to the Canadian Mental Health Association and British Columbia Division to roll out training for British Columbians. And the rollout involved two different workshops. One is an assist workshop or applied suicide intervention skills training, and that's a 2-day workshop that goes over 14 hours. And the other is Safe Talk, which is 3.5 hours. It's a suicide alertness program. So these two programs are a part of this big initiative in the province.
And just to be clear, we're not evaluating the gatekeeper training workshops. That's not our intention with our qualitative study, but rather we're actually quite curious about how this works when you have a target and you have people in place to deliver the training. And we're quite interested in knowing, like, how does this actually work on the ground? And so we're imagining that people who might be listening to this have some investment in the work of suicide prevention, and we'd like to be able to think that our findings could offer something useful for them. So do you want to talk maybe now a little bit about how we designed our study
sure.
So people can understand that?
Yeah. So our study is a focused ethnography, and we've divided into 3 different phases in terms of data collection. So in phase 1, we interviewed 15 stakeholders who had a provincial oversight, if you will, in terms of funding, policy, planning around the implementation of this initiative. And we also interviewed people who were members of a provincial advisory group that had, in essence, a macro perspective on the initiative and were contributing in terms of feedback in a regular way to the Canadian Mental Health Association of British Columbia as the initiative unfolded. The second phase, we looked at spending some time on the ground, doing field observations and interviews with people who are identified as regional coordinators in the province. See, at the outset of the initiative, the Canadian Mental Health Association of BC divided the province into five different regions in order to meet the need within those regions. And I have people on the ground responsible for the actual implementation of the training and even at times facilitating the training. And so we spent some time with four of those regional coordinators across the province, watching them and observing how they were engaging their communities into the training. And then the third phase, we also are going to be, we're just on the cusp of that, we're going to be observing workshops and interviewing participants who have attended either Safe Talk or Assist, Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training, and also interviewing trainers as part of that.
Great. So lots of different perspectives we're trying to get a sense of. And as qualitative researchers, of course, we're interested in the stories that people tell, and we're interested in the accounts that they give of the work that they're doing on a daily basis. And our ears are always attuned to when we hear about tensions or things that were difficult or challenges, that we want to really shine the light on some of those things, because I think this is the area of this work that hasn't been well documented in the scholarly literature. Many publications that report out the results of a training program, but they don't actually show the behind the scenes relational entanglements that are quite precarious at times. And I think that that's what our research is trying to show, is some of the negotiations and the tensions and some of the challenges, as well as the opportunities. And so that's what we hope to share today.
Yes. And so some of the things that we think that might be helpful for practitioners or people who are involved in community development across the province might be useful for them to know in relation to the study and our findings to date is the piece about flexibility that is so needed when you're talking about implementing a standardized program such as Assist or Safe Talk. So maybe you could share a little bit more about the flexibility that's required there, Jennifer.
Sure. And I think one of the things we want to be really clear about is that we hold with deep respect the Living Works educational products, the Assist Workshop and Safe Talk. I mean, they're very high quality, and that's not in dispute. I think what we're curious about is how do communities, as you say, take a standardized workshop and have it make sense for the people living there. And so sometimes we've heard stories about people where there'd been a recent suicide. And so that requires a certain kind of sensitivity about broaching the topic that might look different in a community where there hadn't been a recent death. In other communities, we've heard situations that people want to ensure that they're being culturally sensitive to the location and the history and the context within which they're offering this training, which we agree is an important way to be an educator, that we don't think a one-size-fits-all kind of approach actually can be as helpful as one that's attuned to the local dynamics. And so we've found that community practitioners are often the ones who make those adaptations within the boundaries of also adhering to the quality control that Living Works is expecting. And so those are interesting kinds of ways that people have it be responsive to the local context.
Mm-hmm. And I would also like to add, Jennifer, that the geographic landscape has a huge role in how these workshops are attended or rolled out, in the sense that in some communities, accessibility is a key issue, because transportation to get to a workshop is determined by weather conditions and accessibility on mountain passes that can be closed during certain times of the year due to snow and ice and so on. And so because these workshops are attended in person and trainers aren't located in every single town, every single city, across the province. Getting there, not only for the trainers, but for participants, is quite a hurdle at times, and dependent on so many factors.
And just to build on that, I think some of the other challenges we heard people talk about was the costs of the workshop being sometimes prohibitive. Sometimes people were surprised that there weren't more people coming to the training, and then they had to adapt their strategies for getting people in the door. And so we heard lots of innovative ways that communities were kind of readying the people in the community to receive this training and to be more open to it. The other issue we heard quite a bit is the stigma around suicide, or the perception that it's not a very big problem. We don't need to address that as a priority. So all of these things, I think, are things that we learned might be helpful for community practitioners to be thinking about in advance. And so that would require being in conversation with people of the local community to get a sense of their priorities, their perceptions, what matters most, as opposed to just assuming that we know that this is the right product at the right time. And so that I think what we're suggesting is that there might be some room for some earlier conversations or pre-implementation strategies that people could engage in.
One of the unexpected positive outcomes that came out of this initiative that we've seen in our findings so far is the new networks that were built, the new relationships that were fostered between regional coordinators or trainers, training branches, and so on, with people located within the community, such as city councillors, or people who didn't even think about them having a role in suicide prevention work. And so these new relationships led to increasing knowledge and awareness around not only training, but around suicide prevention. Did you have anything else you wanted to add, Jennifer?
Yes, I just think that idea of these unexpected allies that can be partners in suicide prevention work is a really important finding, because I think often we've thought of suicide prevention being the purview of mental health practitioners. And so I think the more that we see that there are lots of folks who can play an important role in suicide prevention work in communities, and I think the people who are doing this work are pointing the way and helping us to better understand what that networking can look like, particularly in smaller rural and remote communities where there are more innovative partnerships being struck.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Jennifer. I enjoyed this conversation
with
you.
Me too. Thanks, Patty.